from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Silicon Valley catapulted America into the digital technology boom. Leading the way were people who found beauty in computer code and could look decades ahead. But when Sun Microsystems co-founder and computer super scientist Bill Joy looks into the future, he sees a large risk of technology apocalypse. He left Sun last week. Tonight on Point, Bill Joy on the terrifying potential of 21st century technology. But first, in a startling setback for the World Trade Organization, talks on a new global trade agreement in Cancun collapsed yesterday over disagreements between rich Western nations and developing countries. John Authors has been covering the talks for the Financial Times. I asked him what constituted a collapse in Cancun.
What they try to do is to end every ministerial meeting with an agreement that in some way takes forward the process of gradual liberalization of world markets. Such an agreement requires consensus, i.e. every single of the 146 members has to agree. On this occasion, for only the second time, the first having been in Seattle 4 years ago, perhaps more famously remembered for the violence outside the meeting hall, this time they couldn't reach an agreement. So there has been no official progress, no move in any direction compared to where they arrived in terms of what everybody at the WTO can agree to.
And everything seems to have foundered on agricultural subsidies. The United States and Europe said they came to these talks prepared to negotiate on those fronts. What happened?
They do appear to have been prepared to negotiate. I think there are two important points to bear in mind. The first is that the developing world, in the form of the larger poor countries, decided to set up their own negotiating group in the week before the conference, primarily because they felt that the agreement between the US and the European Union was a sinister development for their interests. And they proved to be a very intransigent negotiating team on the bedrock arguments over subsidies. The main country we're talking about there is Brazil, obviously with the still recently elected President Lula trying to establish itself as somewhat of a leading voice in the third world.
The U.S. and Europe said that they wanted their financial companies to have more access to foreign markets and more transparency around how nations, including developing nations, evaluated and awarded contracts. Why wasn't it worth it for developing countries to give that in order to see first world agricultural subsidies cut?
I think that's the second important issue. The actual straw that broke the camel's back wasn't agricultural subsidies, surprisingly enough. It was those, in the jargon, the Singapore issues such as government procurement and competition policy. There are two broad points that can be made about that. The first is that many of the NGOs objected to the idea that the WTO should expand its remit even further. This was seen as beginning to set more and more rules internally for countries rather than merely acting as an arbiter or a referee for international trade.
In other words, we'll tell you how you can put contracts out for bid.
Yes, exactly. And secondly, competition policy involves telling people to do antitrust. And that's something a lot of savvy politicians might prefer not to do, because the kind of people you would be attacking are almost by definition politically powerful. If you've got formerly nationalized industries that have recently been privatized, they're very big and they're very powerful. And if you're then going to start changing the playing field for them, making life harder, that could have political consequences for you at home.
So who are the winners and losers coming out of this, John?
The clearest winners, I think, are those who are totally anti.
Anti-globalization, in other words.
Yes. I mean, that was always their best outcome for the week, was a breakdown. That was quite unambiguous. If you are really not in favor of the gradual liberalization of international trade, then what you want is for a really good, serious stalemate, nobody to move anywhere, recriminations, exactly what has been happening in the last 24 hours. The general joy on the faces of those people was obvious to behold. It's interesting to see the continuing global power of the Beatles, that most of them were singing Lammy Can't Buy the World to the tune of Can't Buy Me Love. The only clear winners are those who are opposed to the whole notion of the WTO and the whole notion of having a global arbiter for the general steady liberalization of free trade.
And the loser then being exactly that vision, the vision of a globalized economy. Progress toward that is stalled here.
No question. I mean, stalled might be too strong a word. There will be more talks in Geneva soon, and there are various models for movement forward. One is the bilateral trade agreement, which perhaps the most famous example is NAFTA, where countries talk to near neighbors about reducing tariffs on a mutually beneficial basis.
So it looks as though the emphasis may shift from big worldwide agreements to one-on-one agreements.
That's certainly one of the most likely scenarios going forward, yes. And one of the perhaps ironic things is that there are certainly people among, if we're not going to call them anti-globalization people, certainly of those who are more skeptical about free trade's benefits for the third world, who believe that that could actually be a worse scenario for the third world than the WTO, simply because if you're one relatively poor country negotiating with the 800-pound gorilla of the US, your negotiating position is very much weaker than if you're in the WTO with many, many allies with whom you can link arms. There's certainly a lot of force to that argument, and something we'll find out a lot more about in the next year or two.
Well, as of tonight, that may be the path we're on. John Authors, thanks very much for joining us.
And thank you.
John Authors is an economic correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Mexico City. Sun Microsystems co-founder Bill Joy warned at the height of the technology boom that unfettered tech progress could be apocalyptic. And technology advances with no controls and no brakes, he cautioned in a groundbreaking article 3 years ago in Wired magazine, could replace our species. People paid attention. This was the pioneering architect of systems that are the backbone of the Internet, cellular telephone networks, and stock exchanges speaking. Bill Joy, the consummate technology guru, was shouting, really, about the dangers of computer-enabled technologies, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, robotics. Last week, Bill Joy stepped down as Sun's chief scientist. Tonight, he steps back with us to look at the promise and peril of this century's technology horizon. Can you imagine computers beating humans to the next rung on the evolutionary ladder? Do you buy that the next generation of technologies are more dangerous than all that have come before? Do we need to throw the brakes on some paths of scientific progress? Can that be done? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Bill Joy. He co-founded Sun Microsystems and stepped down last week as its chief scientist. He spearheaded the development of the computer language Java, which now runs on devices from large computers to smart cards. He led the development of the operating system Unix, the backbone of the World Wide Web. He is one of the most accomplished and revered computer scientists in America. Good evening and welcome, Bill Joy.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Joy.
Bill Joy, we catch you at an interesting moment. You were with Sun for a very long time. You stepped out last week. We want to look back at your big view of technology that you put in front of everyone in the year 2000 and get an update on how you see that today. But tell us first why you've made such a big step after such a long time with Sun. Why stepping out of that dance, Bill Joy?
Well, I stayed at Sun for 21 years and brought to Sun at the beginning some Unix software and work on processor architecture, microprocessor architecture that I've been doing at Berkeley for 7 years before that. So for me, I'd been working on the same thing for almost 30 years and, in fact, had considered leaving Sun earlier in 87 and in 94, 95, but there were big opportunities then and I finally just decided to move on to some new things.
Time to go. Time to do something new. You said you had never expected to stay with one company so long. But what, the pace of progress just kept you there?
Well, in 87, after 5 years at Sun, I had an opportunity to rewrite Unix in a more modern way in a contract to do with AT&T, who owned it at the time. It's now the subject of this SCO lawsuit, which is SCO suing IBM for several billion dollars, I guess. But the ownership at the time was clearly with AT&T, and they in the contract Sun had with them, appointed me to write a new version of it, which is something I had wanted to do for a very long time. And then many years later, In the early 90s, I was about to leave and the web came along and the opportunity to put Java on the web and all these devices came along, and that was just too good a thing to pass up. So I essentially re-enlisted at Sun twice.
But you stayed with it then, but in the year 2000 or sometime before that time, you clearly began having enormous second thoughts about where the whole high technology train was hurtling. You came out with this article in Wired that turned an awful lot of people's heads with some fairly radical forecasting of what might transpire if we're not careful about how technology is handled in this century. Bill Joy, for people who didn't read that article in the year 2000, I wonder if you could give us the outline of it. What was the concern that drove you to stand up and make that big public statement in that year?
Well, I think everybody since then has learned about the dangers of what we call the weapons of mass destruction. And the one that qualifies the most for that description would be a nuclear weapon. A nuclear weapon is based on a chain reaction where one thing leads to two and two leads to four and four leads to eight. And pretty soon you have a very, very large consequence. Historically, things that would have the property of chain reaction were things that were relatively rare. They didn't exist in nature, or they didn't exist in a way that individuals could get a hold of them. Uranium that was weapons grade was hard to get a hold of. So these things were not something anyone could go out and do. What we see with the technologies we're developing for the 21st century is that the ability to create chain reactions no longer requires materials that you can't get a hold of. In fact, often just requires knowledge. So, for example, if you want to cause a chain reaction in the Internet and thereby crash a lot of people's computers or vastly annoy and inconvenience people, you don't need any special raw material. You can do it from your screen at home. This represents a change in the ability of individuals to cause dramatic consequences. We read now about the power failure that affected the East Coast recently, that maybe there was a tree in Ohio that fell on a wire or something, that caused the consequence. Clearly, that was a chain reaction. If you have systems where chain reactions can occur, there's much more danger.
You stood up then and you laid out a number of frightening prospects. One, you said by the year 2030, personal computers will probably be a million times more powerful than they are now, challenging human intelligence. And raised this prospect of the possibility of computers in an era of genetic engineering and nanotechnology and robotics actually becoming or grabbing the next rung on the evolutionary ladder, pulling ahead of humans, leaving humans behind, if indeed they didn't lead to kind of a global physical destruction in conjunction with these other technologies before that could happen.
The point of the computers getting faster is just that they thereby become incredibly powerful tools to design things, and you can design things for good or for evil. For example, the ability to design drugs to cure diseases or genetic therapies is incredibly breathtakingly wonderful, but those same tools can be used to do very bad things. In 2000, when I wrote the article, I would say that the standard answer to someone who was asked, won't bad people do things, is, well, people just don't do things like that. Mm-hmm. That was a standard defense against people thinking about smallpox being used or terrorists doing various things. I think perhaps we're less naive now.
6 months later, 9/11.
Well, it was actually a year and a half later because it was...
Oh, 2001. That's right.
That defense is no longer credible.
Bill Joy, stand by. We've got to take a short break. But before we go there, Jack, Bill Joy lifted the curtain for anyone who hadn't been paying attention on some blood-chilling possibilities.
Yes, his article made me think deeper and fresher than anything I'd read in years. And I think our listeners are in for a survey of the future, the like of which they've never heard in listening to him.
We'll be walking on into that over the rest of this hour. We're talking tonight with Bill Joy, a towering pioneer of the digital age, about information technology as a threat to the human future. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine computers competing with humans for the next rung on the evolutionary ladder? That the PC might be the boss and you the gopher? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Bill Joy, a towering pioneer of the digital age, co-founder of Sun Microsystems, talking about information technology as a threat to the human future. Do you buy that the next big generation of technology will be more dangerous than all that has come before? And do we need to throw the brakes on some strands of scientific progress? Is that possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill Joy, I wish that you would open up these possibilities a little more fully for people who haven't followed it closely. And there's sort of two threads here. One, which you opened, was you say, look, the computer is going to continue to rapidly increase its power to the point where it may challenge human beings for the next rung on the evolutionary ladder. I wish you'd open that up a bit more for us.
Well, people have estimated how much computing power is in the brain, and Ray Kurzweil most famously has produced several books now, one called The Age of Spiritual Machines, where he has tried to estimate, given the rate of progress that we have, when we would expect to see a computer that has the rough calculating power, say, that a human mind does. We don't know enough about a human mind to have the computer simulated, but we would think at that point that computers will be able to out-design and outthink us, and that's a seminal moment in history, certainly, if that's the case.
Now, on that point, you startlingly quoted a famous thinker saying that if and when that point comes, either humankind becomes sort of the pet, the livestock of the computers, or a small elite takes control and the mass of humanity is no longer necessary. That thinker was infamously Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who, of course, was a killer. But whose thought has been widely followed. In any case, you took some heat for that. Michael Lewis, in his book Next, ridiculed the whole idea that the Unabomber had a point. How do you think about it these years on?
Well, I quoted Kaczynski because in reading Kurzweil's book, I had been reading along and not realized he'd switched from writing himself to quoting Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. And when I turned the page, at the sort of the top of the page, this was in the manuscript of the book, it said Kaczynski, and I said, oh, my gosh.
I thought it was Ray Kurzweil.
Kaczynski, how much of Kaczynski did I read? Well, I was thinking it was Kurzweil and thinking it was okay. And that was kind of shocking to me because I couldn't immediately disprove what Kaczynski, you know, I just didn't have an immediate allergic reaction to what Kaczynski had written.
Are these credible options then, or credible futures where somehow the computer meshed with robotics actually sort of takes the head of the evolutionary train?
Well, I think more likely is that if there's enough power around to do that, then something bad will happen that's much simpler to do than that. I mean, it's obviously very difficult to imagine creating a whole other species. But if you have enough computing power, think of the weapons of war you can make and think of the destruction you can cause. We see the kind of disruptions in the Internet, how easy it is for a very small amount of code in a form of a virus to disrupt a very large system. We worry about such disruptions to the other complex technological systems that we've built. So as computers get more and more powerful, they can do things in three dimensions, and you can imagine manufacturing things that go into the real world and have similar kind of bad effects. It's a frightening prospect. So we need to take more collective effort to take control of some of these things.
The key characteristic that you pointed to there was replication. That is, computer-enabled technologies, robotics, genetic engineering, even nanotechnology, that would be different from earlier technologies in that they could self-replicate and therefore presumably evolve, morph, take shapes that they didn't begin with, perhaps shapes and consequences that were never planned.
This is where the truly big messes come from. So a truly big mess is something like the so big virus, which one kid sends it out and suddenly you've got an almost incalculable number of it bugging everybody. Or the power system chain reaction cascades and you've got all of the northeastern U.S. that's down. Or an epidemic like the SARS virus creates enormous havoc for a whole regional economy in part of the world, or the threat of a suitcase nuclear bomb, which is a form of, you know, physical 20th century chain reaction. All these things are the things that can have big effects from small actions, and that's where the danger and the societal management of these things has to apply.
So project that dynamic forward into robotics, into nanotechnology, and what dangers do you imagine there here 3 years on?
Well, 3 years is a relatively short period of time. The most immediate danger is in biotechnology, that someone would bioengineer, make a disease, just like a designer disease against which we have no immunity. So an example of such a disease was SARS with a very high mortality rate. And, you know, we don't have any what the people would call herd immunity. In other words, as a herd, as of the human population, has never seen this before. There may be some natural immunity to it, but most of us don't have any. And so the disease essentially burns through the population the first time the population encounters it. Now, when I wrote the article in 2000, no one had yet essentially made a disease from a computer description of such. Hmm. But in fact, it has been done now. In the last year, someone at a university took a computer file which described the gene sequence of the poliovirus and made one. Just basically printed it out in as a molecule, if you want to think of it that way. They manufactured a polio molecule from parts, from the description. So it's you know, you could say, well, most of the diseases are more complicated than that. Well, printers used to be slower. Computers used to be slower. The things are getting better. So this is clearly a possibility. And the people in the Defense Department are very worried about how we would defend ourselves against something like that.
Jack Beatty, it's not often that a scientist stands up from the midst of his labors with this kind of statement. Bill Joy is hardly alone, but still, it's uncommon. Everybody's lashed into their work, looking for that next breakthrough, looking to found the next company or cure the next disease. And here we've got these images of computers pushing themselves or other technologies ahead of humans in the evolutionary chain of when you go ahead to robotics and nanotechnology, sort of the entire physical universe being at risk of malevolent or just accidental manipulation of these technologies.
Yes, these are images to trouble sleep because they find lodgment in contemporary reality. That's one of the things that gives dystopias authority. For example, Orwell's 1984 had such authority because it was based upon an extension of totalitarianism, something in the world today, or then, certainly then. And similarly with Mr. Joy's vision, it is based on a historical trend that historians call de-skilling, that began with the Industrial Revolution, when we moved from manufacture, from people possessing the means of production in their hand, to the factory, which was a kind of human machine, Marx called it. That was de-skilling. That's what the skill that the manufacturer had went into the machine. That's why the Luddites broke the machines. Well, that tendency, that drive in history, all sorts of forces making for it, technological, political, economic, that drive in the 20th century began more and more to be extended to brain work. That what was de-skilled now wasn't just manual work, but things that people used to do with their brains. Indeed, Taylorism, the movement named after Frederick L. Taylor, the founder of scientific management, was nothing other than an effort to try to de-skill more and more even brain work and routinize it. So in effect, as we enter the 21st century, most routine jobs are machine ready today. Mm-hmm. That is, they're only existing on sufferance of the machine. And the specter of mass unemployment, as machines do more and more, leaving human beings with less and less, is nothing to dismiss. That was one of the dynamics, this business of people having nothing to do and being put out of work and so on, was one of the dynamics that led to fascism and authoritarian government in the 20th century. And that's the second tendency that this builds on, which is the immense coercive power of the state allied with the narcotizing power of the media. Together,
This is a new kind of coercion that you can almost see the state, sending messages to just lull the population into a kind of somnolence while the machines do more and more of their work. It's a frightening and all too, because as I say, it builds on a drive in history, all too plausible scenario, I think.
Bill Joy, this was related to part of what Ted Kaczynski was saying, and God knows the bombs he sent out did terrible damage, but you quote others saying as well, this idea that
Hans
robotics...
Moravec,
yes.
Hans Moravec's, the quote from his book... Mm-hmm. Is much closer to what Jack just said. Mm-hmm. I think there's another historical thing going on. You know, when we first started living together, we had to deal with individuals doing bad things to other individuals, starting with the Garden of Eden. And then, you know, in the era, say, of the nation state, eventually we found ways to end the wars in Europe, you know, thousands of years later, where large groups of people found way to make peace with other large groups of people, mostly, say. And now what we see is we have a lot of individuals still behaving in ways that aren't sustainable. So we have consequences for the planet of individual behaviors that aren't sustainable, say, with global climate change or whatever, global weirdness, as Amory Lovins calls it. But that's still a situation where we have to get the average behavior of large number of peoples to be okay, and then we're kind of okay. We don't have to get everyone to stop giving off CSCs. We just have to get most people to stop giving off CSCs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, the international law and law of the behavior of individuals and rules against corporate misbehavior and CFCs and all, you can get it mostly right and you're okay. Mm-hmm. And so all three, say, evolutions of consciousness here, you can mostly right is good enough.
Yes.
But when you have a situation with somebody who can cause an epidemic, one turns into such a big problem that in many cases one isn't okay. So there's a different standard. Making a rule against somebody doing something and throwing them in jail after they've done catastrophic widespread damage is sort of pointless, especially if they don't care, especially if they're essentially a suicide bomber. That, you know, getting caught doesn't matter. And so that's the situation we're in with these dangerous technologies. We can't legislate away the problem by using punishment as the solution.
You wrote 3 years ago that this new Pandora's box of genetics and nanotechnology and robotics, you say, are almost open, yet we hardly seem to have noticed. Has that changed at all in the last 3 years? There's been a lot of conversation about them. We've had scientists on this show saying, oh, nanotechnology, gray goo, come on, it's not going to happen.
Well, if it does, there won't be anybody necessarily to worry about it, so I suppose it didn't happen in a strange way. But I think after 9/11, everything changed. I've been working for a number of years on a manuscript of a book adapted from the Wired article, and the audience certainly moved. People's awareness of this certainly moved. People's belief that they won't do it certainly failed. I don't think people need to be told that bad people will do bad things anymore. I don't know why we ever believed that they wouldn't.
But you described...
The question is... Mm. Go ahead.
Well, just that you described a fairly, you know, what against the backdrop of Western science is a fairly radical solution here, which was relinquishment. That is, as I understood it, that globally humankind would agree to relinquish or stop pursuing certain technologies.
I actually said I didn't see any alternative. If there's something that's so dangerous that we can't imagine people... what would happen if someone abused it? What else can we do? I think that what I've come to realize more since I wrote the article is that these technologies, say the nuclear weapons or the biotechnologies and nanotechnology, these things were only created over many years by very large groups of people who had, you know, many Nobel laureates, say, involved in the work. They had billions of dollars and trillions of dollars even of research, say. And then we're just going to leave the stuff laying on the street for anyone to do what they want with it? See, I don't think that works. And I think we recognized that early on in the case of nuclear energy that it needed management. But what we have is a situation with genetic engineering and the emerging nanotechnology and robotics that this is being done in the commercial sector without control. So that notion of societal responsibility for the consequences of abuse of this technology is not there. We need something more like a guild where the people who are working on this don't share the secrets with every 15-year-old or terrorist in the world. Teenagers and terrorists don't get everything.
And yet the Internet that you helped empower is one of the main distribution networks for this knowledge these days.
Well, we are rightly in an age where we fear totalitarianism, and management to some sounds like totalitarianism. They would say, well, my access to that is a free speech right. This is, and they equate it with the First Amendment or whatever they want to. But I would argue that something that was created at enormous expense by the society that's very dangerous and also very powerful for good, that everybody doesn't inherently have a right to that. I don't have an inherent right to have access to the nuclear weapons designs that the government created. I think that would be folly to do that. And it's folly to leave these other technologies just laying around when we know that computers will be so powerful that these things will become very dangerous.
Bill Joy, let me turn to the phones. Jeff is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to bring up the fact, I don't know if anybody's heard of the book by Kim Eric Drexler. It's called Engines of Creation. He also wrote one called Nanosystems.
Sure, and Bill Joy refers to them in his article.
Okay, I haven't had a chance to read his article yet. I'll try and pick it up. But he mentions what you call as a gray goo. He talks about having very, very small machines that are able to pick up and place individual atoms right next to each other and essentially replicate and assemble them yourself, and as you were saying. And the gray goo factor, you're essentially converting resources that humans can use by these machines that could potentially go haywire. Now, these are things that we talked about, I think, like nearly 20 years ago.
This idea of turning the whole planet into pudding.
And it's, while it's supposed to be controlled at first, what happens if something goes wrong, as obviously we know things do.
So do you see this as a real and present danger, Jeff, or are you confident that science will regulate itself in such a way that it won't go down that path?
Well, I think we have a major cultural traits in this country that don't lead me to believe that we will be able to control it. One of those being we are always right. Another one of them being that we always need things bigger, better, stronger, and faster. And this is that's the direction we're going with this. So unless we have a moral or ethical change throughout this country and possibly throughout the world, I don't see us being able to stop it so much. And I actually was hoping to bring up one other thing that's not related to nanotechnology, but for the total information awareness system that the government is now developing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that is?
And now, I know this is proposed as a terrorist tracking system, but I wanted to bring, I don't know if anybody's written about this before, but I believe this seemed like a very good device to be able to model people's voting patterns and being able to draw the districting lines for voting people into Congress as such, essentially.
Jeff, you may be getting us a bridge further than we can go there, but thanks for the call. We just got 30 seconds before the break, Bill Joy. But Jeff is out reading and watching and saying, are we constitutionally, even culturally, capable of putting a cork in this?
Well, someone actually, after my Wired article, who is a leading nanotechnologist, did an analysis of whether there's enough energy in the biosphere for it to basically have a machine replicate and eat itself. But these things are real problems, like you pointed out.
We're talking tonight with Bill Joy, a towering pioneer of the digital age, about information technology as a threat to the human future. You can join the conversation. Can human nature live with limits on its exploration? Or is that a dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Bill Joy, co-founder and former chief scientist at Sun Microsystems. He left Sun just last week. In 2000, he was the author of the article in Wired magazine entitled Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Bill Joy was at the forefront of the whole digital revolution. He stood back then, and he's stepping back with us tonight to say, wait a minute, where are we going here exactly? You can join the conversation. Can you imagine computers competing with humans for the next rung on the evolutionary ladder? Do you buy that the next big generation of technologies will be more dangerous than all that have come before? Does this sound like science fiction to you or a genuine concern? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Leah's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Leah. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. By the way, I wouldn't just dismiss science fiction in that way. This vision of the humanity done in, if you will, or made rendered useless by its own technology is certainly as old as the science fiction writers of the 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. who in those days put it in terms of robotics.
And you're saying don't write it off, but pay attention.
I'm saying don't write it off. Pay attention to those people. But I really called because I have a question for mm-hmm. Dr. Joy. And that's about the possible developments of the abilities of computers to emulate the human brain. What's unique, thus far at any rate, to the human brain is its ability to imagine events, activities, creations based on no previous experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thus far, that is not something that computers can do. It's not a matter of computing, no matter how fast, how far, how many parallel processes you might have. Does he think that that is something which it might be possible for computers to develop the ability to do?
Let's find out. Yes. Mm-hmm. And your follow-up there, Leah? In which case?
Pardon?
And you said in which case what?
In which case they become brains.
Yeah. Well, that's the question, isn't it? Let's ask Bill Joy.
Well, it would be hard to know exactly what would constitute a computer being creative, but I think some people would say that there are computer programs that can, for example, write music that sounds original and interesting. There are computer programs that can do art, some of which are printed in one of Ray's books. Some of Brian Eno has generated music in a new album for the Clock of the Long Now, where he's used some algorithms that a friend of mine, Danny Hillis, did to generate bell music. And so I think I can't imagine that computers can do something very creative, and that whether we will be able to reverse engineer the human brain in any reasonable amount of time, we'll see things that we consider creative from computers, and most of us will consider creative computers long before we do that.
Does it matter in terms of your sort of scary scenario here whether or not computers actually have that kind of creativity? Does it matter?
No.
Why not?
Because people will probably, either people or accidents are more likely to be the problem, not the computers. I think what we're seeing is the computers are becoming powerful enough in the 21st century to do three-dimensional science. We had computers powerful enough in the 20th century to do the most of the two-dimensional things we wanted to do. We can do circuits, computer circuits, and so on. But when you start analyzing in three dimensions like protein chemistry, you need machines that are radically more powerful. And when you can start designing in those spaces, that's when essentially all hell will break loose.
Cliff is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Cliff. You're on the air.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you, Cliff.
I wanted to stop some of the worry about the world being taken over by smart machines and all these labor-saving devices like computers. I'm in the manufacturing business making iron castings.
All right.
Hello?
Yes, good. We hear you loud and clear.
Oh, good. Yes. We make iron castings here in America for under $1 a pound, sometimes 50 cents a pound. And I've had a few wide-eyed people come up to me and tell me that smart molecules will be created by the computer age, where soon our industrial arts will be obsoleted by these super intelligent molecules that will stack themselves and tie themselves together so nice to make the hard iron shapes that are our car engines and sewer covers and such.
And how does it ring with you, Cliff? Does it sound realistic or pie in the sky?
Well, I think the profit motive will keep the high technology out of that because it's so cheap to do it now. Just like so many other things we're already doing, like growing corn in the field, it's just so cheap to do it the way we're already doing it that it'll be a really long time before the computers and the sciences come around to take over all these things.
Got it. Cliff, thanks for calling. Bill Joy, respond to that, because you look at the profit motive and you say this may drive us off a cliff. Sorry, Cliff, but Cliff is saying there he does manufacturing, and he sees these technologies as so expensive that he doesn't really worry about them becoming the way of the world.
Well, as I already said, I think the near-term danger from abuse is in the biosciences, from designer diseases or whatever that we can't defend against, things that look more like SARS than a nanobot. But I think this nanotechnology and the science of new materials is actually quite exciting, that we'll be able to create all sorts of interesting new materials by designing them at the molecular level. Some of the earliest ones that are incredible are these buckyballs and carbon nanotubes and fullerenes and these other things that have been discovered, which are forms of chains and sort of garden hose-like arrangements of carbon atoms that have incredible, interesting electrical properties for making computer circuits faster. We'll also see new kinds of materials for making ordinary household objects in the same way that plastics came along, say, 50 years ago.
But is all this so expensive to pursue that it will be slow if happening at all?
No. But in fact, quite the opposite is true. A number of people I know who are working in the area of what we'd call molecular electronics, which is making integrated circuits using chemistry. So instead of making these circuits in a multi-billion dollar fab, wafer fab, as Intel would call it, you can make them in a beaker. So you can use chemistry techniques to essentially grow things in parallel without all this expensive equipment. And that's a new kind of science which is just emerging. So there is a chance for not all materials, but many materials to be manufactured much more cost-effectively and at much more environmental cost, say, than what we do today.
And so you say we've got to look at relinquishment, but you acknowledge that this is in conflict with very basic impulses. You said in 2000, our Western notion of happiness seems to come from the Greeks, who defined it as the exercise of vital powers along lines of excellence in a life affording them scope. That seems to define a world in which scientists would pursue their visions and dreams without so much regard for these, certainly without much love for relinquishing whole paths of inquiry.
Right. Well, I think my view has changed since then in saying that I don't necessarily believe we will not do these things, but that the groups who do them have to take responsibility for limiting the abuse. And I think, for example, the biologists who are creating these technologies that allow new diseases to be created, who also hope you to use the same technology to cure disease, have to take responsibility and limit access to the technology so that we can control the abuse.
You said also in that article that you've always believed that making software more reliable, your sort of life's work, would make the world a safer and better place. You wrote, if I were to come to believe the opposite, then I would be morally obligated to stop this work. I can now imagine such a day may come. Is that what happened last week, Bill Joy? Is that why you left Sun?
No. But I still think, in fact, I'm looking at a possible new venture in the area of dealing with some of these virus threats and things like my article imagines. I would love to have some things that could partially ameliorate the impact of a chain reaction of a self-replicating computer virus.
And are you more or less optimistic about the dark scenario that you drew in 2000, today in 2003?
Well, I wrote the article and I was writing a book, which I'm still working on, to raise people's awareness of these issues. And I was in New York City on September 11th, 2001, and I don't think anything could have made people more aware of the danger. Not everybody's aware of the exact danger I'm talking about, since there are obviously other immediate dangers. But I also talked in the article about the potential impact on our civil liberties, and there's a trade-off between power and freedom. The Greeks understood this. We seem to have forgotten. We're certainly more aware of it now, and it's an issue in the newspapers, I'm sure, this week, with Ashcroft running around and everyone talking about this legislation to the trade-off between security and freedom. And the Founding Fathers understood this very well. The Athenians understood this very well. We need to understand it also.
Bill Joy, you stretch our minds, and we thank you for that, even if the vision is a troubling one. But thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bill Joy, co-founder and former chief scientist at Sun Microsystems. Jack, there's a picture to chill the bones. Let's hope it's not all right.
This is the way the world ends, not with a whimper, but with the green goo.
Or gray. We'll see, or we won't see. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Bill Clinton gives his view on the difference between Republicans and Democrats. This is On Point. The spotlight shone on one particular guest at Senator Tom Harkin's annual steak fry near Des Moines, Iowa this weekend. Former President Bill Clinton stepped up to support the 9 Democrats running for president in 2004, a group which he called the best field of candidates we have had in decades. Clinton then got political himself, attacking President Bush's tax cuts and foreign policy and laying out his vision of the Democratic Party. Here are excerpts from Bill Clinton's Iowa speech.
We make choices, and choices have consequences. Now, the president was not responsible for 9/11, and he wasn't responsible for the collapse of the dot-com market or the telecom market, but since they've been there, they're responsible for the choices they have made. Those are choices they made. And they believe in what they're doing. Why? Because they believe in government by ideology, enemies, and attack. We believe in government by experiment, evidence, and argument. We actually think we might be wrong now and again. We might have to change, not them. People who govern by ideology believe they're entitled to rule. Practical people believe they're fortunate to be given a chance to serve. And when we... So here's the difference. And when people feel under the gun, ideologues look good because you don't want to have any ambiguity or shades of gray. You just want to know, let's put the corn where the hogs can get it and go get our enemies. But there are problems with that. Like when practical people get in a hole, they say, stop digging. Right? Stop digging. So in 2001, we passed this humongous tax cut, and 40% of it went to folks like me. And we did it before we knew what our income, our expenses, our emergencies were. So our income was down, our expenses were up. 9/11, we had a big emergency, had to go spend a bunch of money. And we looked around in 2002 and 3, and we're in a huge hole. So us practical folks, we said, stop digging. But the ideologues, they say, you know what they say when they get in the hole? Give me a bigger shovel. The 2003 tax cut was a bigger shovel. They did it all over again, except more. It will add $2.7 trillion to the national debt at a time when the baby boomers are going to retire, and I do not want my generation's children to be supporting us instead of our grandchildren. It is wrong. We're going to turn around and wonder what in the wide world we were thinking about. We have to say we are not ideological. We are not based on enemies. We are not based on attack. We believe in unity in our diversity. We believe in community. We believe in an America with shared benefits, shared responsibilities, and shared values. We believe in standing up against terror and weapons of mass destruction. But in a world where you can't kill or jail all your enemies, you got to make more friends and fewer terrorists. We believe in being strong. And we believe in being strong around the world, but in the end, we cannot continue to grow strong around the world if we are growing weaker and more divided at home. We must grow together and share together and build together. And we might be wrong. But if we are, we won't ask for a bigger shovel. We'll ask you to join with us and do better to build a better tomorrow. Thank you, and God bless you all.
Former President Clinton speaking in Indianola, Iowa on Saturday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.